the end of the last hour, we were talking about Francis Bacon and his inductive method of a research program in science. You make the observations, you make your lists, and then you compare the lists, and you come up with a conclusion in that fashion. And Aristotle, to some extent, did the same thing. Aristotle was not the deductive scientist that popular opinion has him as today. He was more of the data gatherer, as Bacon suggested. Now, we'll get into the problems of the inductive method in a moment, but I want to make at this time the distinction between this method, the inductive method in scientific research, and the modern scientific method, which is usually called the hypothetical deductive method. Hypothetical deductive method. And this method does not proceed by using pure induction. What happens is that a scientist notices something. Something piques his interest. And he wants to figure out what is going on, whether it's how the stars move or how a pencil moves or whatever, how fire burns wood. And he comes up with a theory that would explain it. This is this half of the method. It's the hypothesis. He comes up with an hypothesis, a possible explanation of why this event is occurring. And then as a result of this hypothesis, he tries to construct an experiment. Let me write that up there. This is an experimental method. There's not much experimentation going on in Bacon or Aristotle's research programs, but the modern research program is an experimental method. Everything is to be subjected to experiments. And he has an hypothesis. He then tries to come up with an experiment to test the hypothesis. He doesn't merely go out and, as Bacon suggested, and look at things that are hot. He takes materials in the laboratory and does things to them. He heats them, or he cools them, or he pours acid on them. Or he mixes them with other things. He actually does things to them rather than simply going out in the world and observing things. He's doing this because he wants to test his hypothesis. He wants to test it. He's going to subject whatever it is that he's interested in to his hypothesis. And he's going to infer from this hypothesis that certain things will happen when he does so. If I add heat to this pot of water, it will boil at 212 degrees Fahrenheit or 100 degrees centigrade. And he's going to test this hypothesis. So he devises an experiment in which he can test it, and he performs the experiment, and he notices the results, and if the results are as predicted, this is going back to prediction again, and Thales and the astronomers, if the results are as predicted, then he will regard his hypothesis as confirmed. So if my hypothesis is that adding heat to a pot of water will cause it to boil, and I do that, and I notice that it's boiling, then I regard my hypothesis as confirmed. Now, let me read a few quotes, and if you have your Christian View of Men and Things here, turn to page 133. Because this is where we get into the popular, and it used to be some of the leading scientists, or at least philosophers of science in this country, had the same idea. But still, the popular idea is very much that science furnishes us with truth. Look at the quotes on page 133. The first one is from A.J. Carlson. And Carlson is no, although his name isn't recognized today among laymen, he's no slouch. He was president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. If you check our website out, trinityfoundation.org, you'll find an essay in there about Carl Sagan and his view of science. I'm sure you've all heard of Carl Sagan. He's no slouch either. He's dead now, but while he was at Cornell, he was one of the leading popularizers of science, at least in the U.S. Perhaps you would even call him a scientist. But this is what Carlson says at the top of 133. Probably the most common meaning of science is a body of established, verifiable, and organized data, secured by controlled observation, experience, or experiment. The element in science of even greater importance than the verifying of facts, the approximation of laws, the prediction of processes, is the method by means of which these data and laws are obtained, and the attitude of the people whose labor has secured them. What is the method of science? In essence, it is this: the rejection in toto of all non-observational and non-experimental authority in the field of experience. When no evidence is produced in favor of a pronouncement other than personal dicta, past or present revelations in dreams, or the voice of God, the scientists can pay no attention whatsoever except to ask, how do they get that way? So here you have the emphasis on experiment. And the experiment furnishes us with a body of established, verifiable, and organized data. Then Clark quotes Carl Pearson in the middle of page 133. The classification of facts and the formation of absolute judgments upon the basis of this classification, judgments independent of the idiosyncrasies of the individual mind, essentially sum up the aim and method of modern science. The classification of facts, the recognitions of their sequence and relative significance, is the function of science. Science gives us facts. It gives us facts and it classifies facts. He quotes many other scientists on these pages. Look at the next one on 134. Another quote from Carl Pearson. The goal of science is clear. This is about a third the way down the page. It is nothing short of the complete interpretation of the universe. Science does much more than demand that it shall be left in undisturbed possession of what the theologian and metaphysician please to term its legitimate field. It claims that the whole range of phenomena, mental as well as physical, the entire universe is its field. It asserts that the scientific method is the sole gateway to the whole region of knowledge. The scientific method is the sole gateway to the whole region of knowledge. Then on page 135, Clark gives a short quotation from Gilbert, an earlier scientist who had written on magnetism, whose aim was that his conclusions were established not with mere probability, but with certainty. So we're dealing here with a method, the scientific method, whether you prefer this version of it, the more inductive version, or the hypothetical deductive version, that claims to be the sole gateway to all truth. The sole gateway to the whole region of knowledge. This is a point of view that is probably no longer held by most scientists, but it is a point of view that is commonly held by non-scientists. Science has given us tremendous things. Look around you. We've got fluorescent lights, and think of what's behind them. The power plants that provide them. We've got computers. We've been to the moon. We've got hospitals equipped with CAT scanners and all the latest technology, all of which have been used to make our lives more comfortable, to keep us healthier, and so on and so forth. So the common view is that science has provided us with these things because science has discovered truth about the universe. This method in particular, not so much Bacon or just the collection of data, but this method in particular, experimental science. Well, a critique of science, I think, would have to begin or ought to begin with quoting someone who is not a Christian about these methods. And I want to begin by quoting, if I can find my reference here, Bertrand Russell, who no one would mistake for a Christian. In fact, he wrote an essay called Why I'm Not a Christian, in which he attacked Christianity. And I have misplaced my reference to him, so I'll come back to Russell in a minute. Let me put something up on the overhead here. Here's a quote from Russell. This will do. Russell, as you can see, lived to be almost 100. Can you see that? Is that bright enough? Okay. This is what he says about inductive arguments, but in the course of his comments about inductive arguments, he brings in the experimental method as well. It says, all inductive arguments, which is what we're talking about with Bacon, where you collect instances of things. And then after you look at all these instances of things, you conclude that heat is motion. You come up with a general conclusion. You look at particulars and you come up with a general conclusion. That's the form of an inductive argument. And this is what Russell writes. He says, all inductive arguments reduce themselves to the following form. If this is true, that is true, now that is true, therefore this is true. And he's frank enough and honest enough to say this is a logical fallacy. Now, induction in the narrow sense is a logical fallacy for a different reason. The reason is that you cannot reach a general conclusion no matter how many particulars you have in the premise. You cannot reach a universal conclusion no matter how many particulars you have in the premise. And the common example in logic textbooks is you want to figure out what color swans are. So you go out and observe swans. And you observe 10,000 swans. They're all white. So you reach the conclusion, swans are white. All swans are white. This would be comparable to Bacon, going out and looking at instances of heat to try to figure out what heat is and concluding that heat is motion. The difficulty is, of course, that you may have overlooked the black swan, or perhaps the black swan has already died or is yet to be hatched. Or perhaps there's a swan in Australia you haven't seen who doesn't happen to be white. So no matter how many particulars you can pile up, you can never complete the induction. You can never have as many particulars as needed to reach the conclusion that all swans are white. Now, strictly speaking, that's the problem with the inductive argument. But Russell here brings up another problem. He says, the form of the argument is, if this is true, that is true, now that is true, therefore this is true. This is actually the form of the hypothetical deductive argument. This argument is formally fallacious. Suppose I were to say, if bread is a stone and stones are nourishing, then this bread will nourish me. Now this bread does nourish me, therefore it is a stone and stones are nourishing. If I were to advance such an argument, I should certainly be thought foolish. You probably can't see the bottom there. Yet it would not be fundamentally different from the argument upon which all scientific laws are based. Now, let me emphasize, Russell's no Christian. But he does understand the logic of the situation. And this foolish argument about bread and stones is the same sort of argument, the same form of argument, as you find in the hypothetical deductive method. You frame the hypothesis, if bread is a stone and stones are nourishing, then this bread will nourish me. That's the hypothesis. Then you devise an experiment, and you eat the bread. Now this bread does nourish me, therefore it is a stone, and stones are nourishing. You have a hypothesis, you have an experiment, you have a predicted result, you obtain that result, therefore your hypothesis is true, or confirmed. What's important is not the particular terms in the argument, whether it's bread or stones or heat or motion or whatever it might be. It's the form of the argument, the logical form of the argument. And this is the fallacy of asserting the consequent that characterizes the hypothetical deductive method of modern science. Notice Russell's last statement, it's not fundamentally different from the argument upon which all scientific laws are based. Well, before I give you any more criticism of this method, and I will give you some more, let me talk briefly about what it means to explain something. Science says that it is explaining things to us. Russell here has pointed out, of course, that this isn't an explanation at all, but it's not an explanation. Science cannot explain anything in another sense. Here's a quote from Newton about gravity. As you know, Newton developed the law of gravitation. And this is what Newton wrote about gravity. He says, I have not been able to discover the causes of those properties of gravity from phenomena, and I frame no hypotheses. Because I'm not going to speculate. I frame no hypotheses. He says, I have not been able to discover the causes of those properties of gravity from phenomena, and I frame no hypotheses. We take, we have this idea that gravity is obvious. You drop something, it falls. Say, well, what did that? Well, gravity did that. Well, what have we explained? All we have observed is the fall of that pen to the floor. Are we any further along in our understanding of things than the ancients, who said, it's not attraction, it's love that explains the behavior of things. We call gravity an attraction at a distance between physical bodies. Well, is attraction any better than love in explaining why the pen goes to the floor? Have we made any advance here in explaining anything? Newton says he couldn't explain. He says, I can't discover the causes of those properties of gravity from the phenomena. Can't explain. gravity, or science can give us descriptions of things. The law of gravitation is that the force varies according to the distances, the square of the distances and the masses. And that's just a description of the law of gravitation. The question is, why does that thing drop? We don't want to know how fast it drops. We want to know why it drops. And the philosophers of science have come up with the idea that description is explanation. If you can describe something, you've explained it. But is that true? Have you explained it if all you do is describe it? If you can even describe what occurs. assuming we've solved the problem of motion. If you can even describe it, have you explained it? Or does explanation require something else? Newton thought it did. And he says, I'm unable to discover what it is. Well, of course, Einstein wouldn't have denied that the pen fell on the floor. But Einstein has no idea of gravity in his theory. There is no gravity in Einstein's theory. There is, in Einstein's theory, the curvature of the space-time continuum. There is no force. In fact, Newton himself could not understand how a physical body out here and a physical body out here would attract one another. He could not understand what he called force at a distance. Why would one physical body attract another physical body? Strange idea. He called it force at a distance, didn't understand it. Einstein comes along in the 20th century and says there is no force at a distance. There's nothing called gravity. When we observe the motion of planets, when we observe the motion of things on Earth, we're observing nothing but objects moving along the space-time continuum. And there's no forces attracting them toward each other. And Einstein made several predictions based on his theory, and people performed experiments based on those predictions and got the results that Einstein predicted. Now, the interesting thing about Einstein, and I'll quote Einstein in a moment, is that he never would regard his theories as true. Einstein understood the logic of the situation, and he didn't make the mistake of jumping to the conclusion that just because the results he predicted came about, that his theories were true. He was much more cautious in his statements. Let me see if I can find something here, an overhead. Well, here's one that mentions Einstein, and it begins with the fallacy of asserting the consequent, so I'll put this one up. Here's an example. I've used this before, I think, probably when I taught logic out here. The fallacy of asserting the consequence. In symbolic logic, it's if P, then Q, Q, therefore P. If you put English words in it, if it's raining, the streets are wet, therefore it's raining. You have a theory, the hypothesis. If it's raining, the streets are wet. You perform the experiment. You go outside and look. You observe the streets are wet, and therefore it's raining. And you conclude that. You can think of any number of arguments like this. If your battery is dead, your car won't start. You turn the ignition key, you perform the experiment, you come up with an idea of how to test this hypothesis. Your hypothesis is if your battery's dead, the car won't start. You turn the ignition key, the car doesn't start, therefore your battery's dead. Now, a mechanic wouldn't make that mistake. He wouldn't make that mistake in reasoning. But scientists do it all the time with this hypothetical deductive method. There are several reasons why the streets might be wet. Maybe a street cleaner just went by. Maybe they're flushing out the fire hydrant. Maybe somebody's lawn sprinkler is overshooting. Several possibilities. There are several possibilities why your car won't start. So the observed result, the predicted result, doesn't indicate that your theory is correct. Here's another one with Einstein in it. If Einstein's theory is correct, the atomic bomb will explode. The atomic bomb does explode, therefore Einstein's theory is correct. People think that when it went off in New Mexico in 1945, this proved Einstein correct. But you see, it's the same mistake in reasoning that you find in bread and stones in Russell's example, or the streets being wet because of rain. Here's another one that strikes a little bit closer to home for Christians. If creation is true, there will be gaps in the fossil record. There are gaps in the fossil record, therefore creation is true. Same logical mistake. Same error in reasoning. Now, we like this argument because the conclusion is something we agree with. Creation is true. And this is how Christians are frequently fooled. Because somebody will come along and offer an argument, the conclusion of which they agree with, so therefore they think the argument is a sound argument. But it's not. It's the same logical error. If creation is true, there will be gaps in the fossil record. So we look at the fossil record, we find there are gaps, and we conclude, therefore, that creation is true. This is the mistake that the scientific creationists make. In arguing from creation, or for creation, from the fossil record. You argue for creation from the scripture. It's given to us by revelation. Not by the hypothetical deductive method. Many people are fooled by proofs for the existence of God in the same way, because the conclusion of the argument is, therefore God exists. Well, great, we like that conclusion. So we're fooled into thinking this must be a good argument if it arrives at a correct conclusion. Let me give you an example of a logical argument, the conclusion of which is true or correct, and the premises of which are both false. Let's take the argument, all Washingtonians, citizens of Washington, all citizens of Washington are vegetarians. I don't think that's true. Assume it's a false premise. How about the second premise, the minor premise being all vegetarians are Americans? Well, that's probably not true either. But the conclusion from those two premises is all citizens of Washington are Americans, which is a true conclusion, derived from two false premises. So don't be fooled into thinking either that the premises are true or the form of the argument is good and the argument sound just because you like the conclusion of an argument. You have to examine the whole package. You want me to repeat that last one? It's all citizens of Washington are vegetarians, a false premise. All vegetarians are Americans, a false premise. And it follows by the rules of logic that all citizens of Washington are Americans. Which is true. Be careful about buying arguments whose conclusions you agree with and believe to be true simply because the conclusions are something you agree with. Always go back and examine the argument, whether it's an argument for creation or an argument for science or whatever. Always go back and examine the argument. And don't be fooled by them. Okay. Let me give you some other... Let me see if I have any more overheads here that would be useful at this point. I don't see anything. let me give you some more quotations from non-Christians, if I can find the proper book here. On this matter of science. One of the recent philosophers who has advanced the idea that science furnishes us with truth is the novelist and philosopher Ayn Rand. And I won't quote anything from her. I've quoted stuff that other men have said. I'll simply quote some non-Christian analysis of scientific method. One of the most influential philosophers of science in the 20th century is an atheist named Karl Popper, P-O-P-P-E-R, a British philosopher. And here's a quote from Popper's essay called Two Kinds of Definitions. It says, although in science we do our best to find the truth, we are conscious of the fact that we can never be sure whether we have got it. And I want to emphasize the never. We know that our scientific theories must always, and I want to emphasize the always, remain hypotheses, that is, unproven. In science, there is no knowledge in the sense in which Plato and Aristotle understood the word. I might add, in the sense in which the Bible understands the word. In the sense which implies finality. In science, we never, notice the never again, have sufficient reason for the belief that we have attained the truth. What we usually call scientific knowledge is, as a rule, not knowledge in this sense, but rather information regarding the various competing hypotheses and the way in which they have stood up to various tests. It is, using the language of Plato and Aristotle, information concerning the latest and the best tested scientific opinion. Now, this view means, furthermore, that we have no proofs in science, in the empirical sciences, which alone can furnish us with information about the world we live in. Proofs do not occur, if we mean by proof an argument that establishes once and forever the truth of a theory. Now, if you want to see a practical examples of what Popper is talking about, just pay attention to the news. And one week you'll find out that eggs are good for you, and the next week you'll find out that they're bad for you. One week you'll find out that the universe is 15 billion years old, and the year later you'll find out it's 12 billion years old. The opinions of the scientists are continually changing. And it's amazing that people can think there is any settled conclusion in science, or that science gives us what Popper here calls finality. Here's another quote. Einstein declared that his theory was false. He said that it would be a better approximation to the truth than Newton's, but he gave reasons why he would not, even if all predictions came out right, regard it as a true theory. Even if they all came out right. It can be shown by purely mathematical means that degrees of corroboration can never be equated with mathematical probability. Now, this is an important point. You might say, well, let's perform this experiment. Let's do it over and over and over again. And if we get the same results every time, certainly then we can conclude that this theory is true. Popper says, the degree of corroboration can never be equated with mathematical probability. It can even be shown that all theories, including the best, have the same probability, namely zero. Very, very important point. The same probability, namely zero. Well, what does he mean by this? Well, one way of illustrating it is the way that Clark does in that chapter on science and a Christian view of men and things. He says, after the scientist has performed his experiment, or while he's performing it, he collects data. He does measurements. And then he takes those measurements and he correlates the variables. And he constructs an axis, an XY axis, and puts the points on the axis. He may go on and calculate standard deviations or deviations from the mean or whatever it might be. And he may end up with areas on the axis rather than points. It doesn't make any difference whether they're areas or points. It might be easier to see if you think of them as areas on an axis. But through those things, any number of lines can be drawn, whether they're points or areas. Now, what the scientist does is he draws a line that looks best to him. He may have scatter points that he draws a line through because that looks best to him. He may try to connect all the dots, as it were, and draw a line. But there's an infinite number of such lines that could be drawn. And if there are an infinite number of possible lines through these data points on a graph or data areas on a graph, then the probability of picking the right one is zero, if there's an infinite number of possibilities. The chances that you'll get the right one don't exist. They're zero. There's an infinite number of possible lines. Back to Popper. Now, the way in which knowledge progresses, and especially our scientific knowledge, is by unjustified and unjustifiable anticipations, by guesses, by tentative solutions to our problems, by conjectures. These conjectures can never be positively justified. They can neither be established as certainly true or even as probable. And since we can never know for certain, there can be no authority here, nor any claim to authority, nor conceit over our knowledge, nor smugness. Now, this, keep in mind, this is not a Christian with an axe to grind against science. This is a philosopher of science, an atheist, who I'm sure would much prefer to be able to say science gives us a body of proven facts. This is what the lawyers call an admission against interest. If you can put a witness on the stand and get him to testify to something that is against his own interest, he's much more credible than a witness who testifies in his own interest. But if you can get him to testify to something against his interest, as this Karl Popper, this atheist, is doing, much more credible. It says, false theories often serve well enough. Most formulae used in engineering or navigation are known to be false, and they are used with confidence by people who know them to be false, because they work. All scientific statements are hypotheses or guesses or conjectures which have turned out to be false. I'm going to repeat that one again. These are all quotes from Popper. All scientific statements are hypotheses or guesses or conjectures which have turned out to be false. Popper's recommendation for a research program is perform the experiments, make the mistakes as fast as you can, and you'll find out what works better then. Just get in there and make the mistakes as fast as you can. It's trial and error, and make the errors as fast as you can. And then you'll find what works and what doesn't work. Another quote from Popper, our attempts to see and to find the truth are not final, but open to improvement. Our knowledge, our doctrine is conjectural. It consists of guesses, of hypotheses, rather than a final and certain truth. I've quoted only from Popper, but you might quote from any number of philosophers of science in the 20th century who make the same statements or similar statements about the scientific method. So where does that leave us? We have, on the one hand, people like A.J. Carlson and Carl Pearson saying things like science is the sole gateway to knowledge. And then you have folks like Karl Popper saying, there is no knowledge in science. All we have is guesses, conjectures, hypotheses, none of which we can ever show to be true. We have logicians like Bertrand Russell saying that the arguments upon which all scientific laws are based are fallacious arguments. In the mind of ordinary people, one of the questions that arise is, if something's false, how can it work? Don't things have to be true to work? How can something false work? Well, Popper mentioned in there that engineers and navigators frequently use formulas that they know to be false because they work. And I've given this example before. I'll give it to you again this evening. Maybe you've forgotten.
Vancouver is due east of Walla Walla, Washington. Vancouver is due east of Walla Walla, Washington. Now, you'd probably tell me I'm all wet. Wouldn't you tell me it's due west of Walla Walla? But I've got a hypothesis that it's due east. And I figure if I travel due east, I get to Walla Walla. So I travel due east, and I get to Walla Walla. I'm sorry? Well, I start in Vancouver. Well, I meant to start in Vancouver. I said Vancouver is due east of Walla Walla. And I leave here. I have to leave in Walla Walla. You're getting me confused here. Yeah. Is that true or false? You won't agree that Vancouver is due west of Walla Walla? That do. But whatever the case here, I can operate on what most of you would take to be a false statement and have it confirmed by my travel experiment. And then you're left with saying, well, this theory that he has might be true. But it's not. Clark, in his Philosophy of Science, and I hope to read it, gives several other examples of false theories working. And there's no reason. Now, many false theories don't work, but some false theories do. Now, we're not saying that all false theories work, but there are many faults that don't work. Yes, sir, ma'am.
If a false theory works, it's false. How do you determine?
Well, I'll get into that in the next hour.
Right.
I think our time's up here. Good. Come back in 15 minutes, and I'll try to.